The agency was not doing a good job on this trip of winning the heart of the man they needed on board to make the Afghan program work. There was also another slight, one that seems almost incredible, given the effort the agency was making to strengthen its relationship with Yousaf. For reasons that were quite inexplicable to Vickers, the CIA protocol team in charge of organizing the brigadier's schedule had decided that Yousaf would enjoy going to the theater. Brigadier Mohammed Yousaf is a fundamentalist Muslim who turns to Mecca 5 times a day in prayer and who has made the pilgrimage to Mecca. By nature, he is suspicious of Christians. The play the CIA selected for him to attend with Vickers and Avrakatos at Ford's Theater was Godspell. It was, needless to say, a very grim-faced Pakistan general who sat between Vickers and Avrakatos that evening. His arms folded over his barrel chest, he scowled at the musical, whose author clearly had not understood that Muhammad was the greatest of all the prophets. All was not lost, however. The agency's relationship was saved in part by Yousaf's enormous respect for Avrakatos's boss, Bert Dunn, the Near East Division Chief. Dunn had served in Afghanistan and had been responsible during the Kennedy years for helping Pakistan establish its own special forces unit. He spoke Dari and Pashto and was much loved by the Pakistan military, which had known and trusted him for years. Yousaf was pleased to receive Dunn's praise for all he was doing for the jihad. But things broke down with Yousaf again over the most basic question of how to arm an insurgent movement. Yousaf didn't want to let the CIA ship the huge amount of ammunition that Vickers felt was absolutely necessary to keep the fighters in steady combat. When Yousaf cited insufficient infrastructure to transport the ammunition, Vickers countered by getting Gust to offer to build warehouses, upgrade train tracks, buy thousands of new trucks, even ship in mules and camels. More complicated was Yousaf's adamant insistence that the CIA equip all of the Mujahideen with AK-47s. Vickers had been the biggest critic of the bolt-action Enfield in favor of the AK, but his objective now was to create a lean, tough, well-armed guerrilla army. The last thing he wanted was to buy hundreds of thousands of AKs and then not be able to give anyone enough ammunition for sustained combat. The agency was not about to make this point directly, and Vickers, the rough equivalent of an army captain in Brigadier Yousaf's eyes, was not inclined even to suggest such a thing. So something of an impasse was reached in which Vickers could not say either that he was worried about corruption or that he felt Yousaf was an imbecile when it came to military strategy and tactics. The net result was a logjam, which appeared to be unmovable until Avrakatos intervened with a bit of bakshish distributed skillfully at just the right moment. At one of those dreary official receptions in Islamabad where the Muslim government serves only fruit juice, Avrakatos ran into Brigadier Raza, the Pakistan ISI general who had held Yousaf's job during Howard Hart's tour. Unlike Yousaf, Raza was no fundamentalist. He liked Americans and they liked him, and Raza was not offended when Avrakatos showed him the flask he had concealed in his suit and offered to spike the general's fruit juice. After accepting his fourth ration of Russian vodka, Raza volunteered a suggestion. Perhaps the CIA would have more luck with the ISI if Avrakatos would consider giving a contract for ammunition to a certain Pakistani arms manufacturer. Avrakatos had $500 million to spend on arms that year, so he quickly gave $8 million of that to the Pakistanis to make 303 ammunition for the Mujahideen. It was chicken feed, he said. We paid a penny or two more per round, but we didn't have to pay for transportation. I had Charlie come out and go through the factories with me, and we complimented the Pakistanis on their quality control. In such a manner, apparently, was the barrier to the historic CIA escalation removed. Avrakatos does not assert any direct quid pro quo or claim that Yousaf's troublesome positions were anything but the product of his wrong-minded professional judgment, but for whatever reasons, the agency officials most knowledgeable about these negotiations do say that after the placement of this relatively small arms contract, the Pakistani resistance disappeared. For Avrakatos, dealing with crisis became routine, but at one point in 1985 he found himself having to cope with a screaming problem that seemed to belong to another century: mules. The challenge of secretly moving tons of weapons into position for the Afghans was always a logistical nightmare. The CIA had literally hundreds of millions of rounds of ammunition constantly traveling by sea and air to Pakistan. Once in Pakistan, the lethal goods were transported by train and truck to the border. At that point, however, everything had to move the old-fashioned way, if not on a man's back, then by mule or camel. The Russians, therefore, placed the highest priority on hunting down and slaughtering the Mujahideen's long mule caravans. So many of these beasts were wiped out by gunships that in 1985 an urgent call suddenly came into the task force headquarters, warning of a crisis that had placed everything at risk. "Where the fuck do you go to buy donkeys?" Avrakatos remembers asking Vickers. Later, an incredulous CIA director called Avrakatos. "You've got to be kidding me. You're buying mules?" In fact, Avrakatos soon had agents all over the world looking for the best deal on mules. When the Egyptians landed one of the first major contracts, the Pakistanis got insanely jealous and began complaining about health hazards because a number of mules had died shortly after arrival. They insisted on health certificates for the next batch, presuming this would force the agency to buy locally. But Mohammed Abu Razala's resourceful arms salesman, General Yahya al-Gamal, wanted the next contract for 2,500 mules at $1,300 each, cash on delivery, so he engineered a great Egyptian put-down. "You have to realize that donkeys and mules are the lowest form of life in Egypt," explains Avrakatos. "Even a camel has greater status. But the Egyptians provided each donkey and mule with an ID card and vaccination certificate." As if that wasn't enough to make fun of the Pakistanis, General Yahya outfitted every donkey with a piece of plastic sporting an Arabic name. Yahya thought it was hysterical. He even gave them passports. According to Avrakatos, the Pakistanis only reluctantly accepted this zanily credentialed herd, but they were sufficiently insulted that they refused to permit any more Egyptian mules into Pakistan. The experiences of the CIA buying and shipping mules to Afghanistan over the next few years became the subject of legendary stories in the halls of Langley. At one point, the Pakistanis became so ornery that they wouldn't permit the CIA's transporter to leave the mule manure in Pakistan. They made the planes carry the smelly droppings back to Europe. It would take months to establish the mule supply lines. One early shipment of sorry creatures purchased in Brazil arrived in Pakistan with all the animals dead. Eventually, the Mujahideen were moving their supplies on the backs of Tennessee mules, and the halls of Langley were soon filled with rumors, later confirmed by the agency's spies, that the freedom fighters were copulating with these animals. In an attempt to paint a bright face on this curious practice, Avrakatos explained that in Greece and other Near Eastern cultures there is no scorn placed on buggery as long as the person in question assumes the right position. "The key question is whether you are the fucker or the fuckee," he said. The Mujahideen were taking the dominant male role here, thus by their code of honor, Gust explained, there was no cause for shame. The officer of logistics, however, was not as understanding as Avrakatos. They were quite appalled by the stories, particularly when they learned that the Mujahideen had also eaten a number of their prized Tennessee mules. No sooner had Avrakatos's operatives dealt with the mule crisis than he was faced with a new and truly threatening challenge. The White House had taken Andeyeva and Gordon Humphrey's accusations of corruption in the CIA pipeline to heart and had demanded a major policy review. Now that hundreds of millions of dollars were at play with an uncertain outcome on the battlefield, Avrakatos understood that it would be devastating if the conclusion were drawn that the Pakistanis were stealing the CIA blind. It isn't easy to control graft in a massive covert arms operation like the Afghan War, and certainly some level of corruption is part of doing business in the Third World. Gust found it perfectly acceptable to dole out an $8 million contract now and then if it bought him cooperation. At the same time, he understood that crude corruption could bring them all down. For that reason, the task force had adopted all kinds of extraordinary measures to keep their allies honest. Here, Art Alper's boys made all the difference by placing tiny sensors in random shipments of weapons, which were then followed by satellite to see where they ultimately went. Spies were recruited among the Mujahideen themselves, as well as from the ranks of the Pakistani military. Finally, the agency also ran a network of 15 third-country agents, neither Pakistani nor Afghans, but Europeans operating inside the war zone under the cover of being foreign journalists, doctors, or documentary filmmakers. They reported how the Mujahideen were doing militarily as well as whether the money, food, and arms shipments were getting through. Beyond that, satellites were now regularly being used to verify Afghan claims of downed planes and tanks. The task of responding to the White House fell on Vickers' shoulders, and instead of looking at it as a defensive exercise aimed simply at keeping the bureaucrats from closing the operation down, he saw it as an opportunity to win their support. He quickly spelled out the full range of measures that had already been put in place to prevent the kind of corruption that Ayeva and Humphrey alleged. He had no doubt that his detailed explanation would lay the corruption matter to rest. One of the questions from the White House asked for an explanation of the program's overall objective. Clearly, the volume of weapons and support flowing into Pakistan now dwarfed the intent of the original presidential findings, so Vickers went on the offensive. Rather than pretend that Afghanistan was still a bleeding campaign, Vickers urged Avrakatos and Bert Dunn, the division chief, to come clean and to acknowledge that the agency now believed that the policy should unapologetically be to win the war. Avrakatos and Dunn signed off, and Vickers reduced the answer to a simple and momentous line for the president to endorse, which he did in National Security Decision Directive, NSDD 166. The objective of the CIA's campaign, he wrote, was now to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan by all means available.